This is the second day of this December 2009 four-day session, and we'll resume reading from yesterday's text to the teachings of the Japanese Zen master Tore from the late 1700s and 1800s, the Dharma heir of Hakuin. The text the book we're using is The Original Face, an anthology of Rinzai Zen. Yesterday, he went over, he began talking of the, what he calls the five discriminations. We went through the first, which is the meaning of same nature, that is the identity of Buddhas and ordinary people. The second is the meaning of different paths, and that's what we're on now. And he's about to take up the 12-fold link of dependent co-arising. This is not so much a Zen thing. Ordinarily, you don't come across it that much in Zen, other than here. It's a broader Buddhist concept, but a very important one. One of the major aspects of Buddhist doctrine is this 12-fold chain of different translators give it a different name: dependent co-arising, conditioned genesis, and others. But this is basically the wheel of existence, what keeps driving us from one lifetime to another. Here, the translator says the 12 causal conditions. And Tore says, also the 12 causal conditions for those who can become enlightened by understanding conditionality are as follows. When the original mind is in the dark, it produces various activities. These are the two conditions, ignorance and action. It all arises. Well, you can, these 12 links, you can see as a circular chain of causality. And so you can come in, look at any one of the 12 and consider it the first, because it conditions the next. But one of the most common ways to start it is ignorance. Ignorance of the way things are. This is what gives rise to greed, anger, and delusion, and basically all suffering. So he mentions these two, ignorance and actions. As actions accumulate, they become instinctive. The parents copulate, and the embryo dwells within. These are consciousness and name and form. When the body is complete and its six faculties finally developed, that is the six senses, this is called the six media of sense. Being born, yet not yet distinguishing good and bad, is called contact. After the age of two or three, people already enjoy good tastes and beautiful colors. This is called sensation. After the age of 10, there is longing for goods and sex. This is called craving. Past 15 or 16, people greedily cling to one thing after another. This is called grasping. From the age of 20, when you do your adult work without fear of wrongdoing, is called becoming. When you are doing what you do and piling up faults, the condition of your future life, for good or bad, is decided therein. This is called birth. Doing such things all your life, you get old and feeble and die. These are called the 12 causal conditions of human life. Those who are enlightened by understanding these conditions examine them, put an end to passion and affliction, and enter enlightenment. These are all techniques of the enlightened ones for entering the way. So, for example, he says, when you understand the true nature of the mind darkened by ignorance, then ignorance becomes identical to the enlightened nature. Action is the way. Consciousness becomes the power of knowledge. Then, that's just naming the first three, then the 12 causal conditions all accord with the right way and eventually arrive at the great realization of liberation. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but each one of these links that can perpetuate our bondage to suffering also has this dual nature, where if we see through the real nature of it, then we can use it. We can use it as a point of liberation. Just in the way he said for the first three of them. The six senses can breed all kinds of attachment, but if we do not cling to the sense experiences, then they become vehicles of liberation. We know that one of the most common triggers to awakening is the sense of sound, hearing. Contact can breed attachment, but it can also awaken the mind. Same with sensation, craving, I'm going to go too far afield by getting too far into this, so let's just move on. He gets now into the six perfections, or the six paramitas, which the translator calls the six transcendences. The six transcendences of bodhisattvas are generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. The preceding two gateways of practice of disciples and those enlightened by understanding conditions benefit oneself only individually and do not have the principle of helping others. Bodhisattvas include the teaching of others in practicing the way for their own benefit as well. They do not spare their wealth when it is for the true way. They make offerings to teachers and give donations to the poor. This is called material generosity, or just ordinary dana. According to their own depth of knowledge and virtue, they teach and influence others. This is called generosity with the teaching. Practicing these two kinds of giving to all sentient beings is called the transcendence of generosity. So he mentions two forms of dana, or generosity, the first of the six paramitas, giving in a material way, giving through teaching, and then the dana paramita, which is transcending these, seeing through these entirely. And then he says, inwardly guarding your spirit of the way, observing fundamental ethics and their ramifications, is called the transcendence of morality. That's the second paramita. Accepting the truth you see, not affected by circumstances of blame or praise, not giving birth to a single thought of anger or resentment, is called the transcendence of tolerance or patience, forbearance. That's the third. let's just go back over that one. It's variously translated as patience or forbearance or tolerance. Generally, it means those responses in the face of mistreatment of some kind, of others causing you suffering. That's why he mentions accepting the truth, you see, not affected by circumstances of blame or praise, not giving birth to a single thought of anger or resentment. It's called the transcendence of patience. Now, of course, in all of these, just as with the precepts, they can be understood in different ways, and they are interpreted differently depending on the circumstances. So, for example, if someone were to be abusing you verbally or some other way, it very well might call for speaking up without anger, but speaking up, pointing out things. But there are also conditions where one is where the perpetrator of the abuse, the verbal abuse or other kind of abuse, is simply playing out his or her own issues, and in some of those cases, the best thing is to just roll with it and not speak up. It can be pointless. It can be provocative. Well, this is also a very complex and far-reaching topic. And then he takes the next one, effort. Growing day by day in the great work of helping yourself and helping others, warding off laziness, and diligently progressing is called the transcendence of effort. And then meditation. Concentrating wholeheartedly on directed effort in sitting meditation and becoming free from all illusions is called the transcendence of meditation. And then the last one, wisdom, or prajna, exhaustively studying the principles of the teachings and examining the intent of the Buddha, consciously breaking up all delusive feelings, is called the transcendence of wisdom. These are called the six transcendences of bodhisattvas. You could also say that each of these six, all six of these, as perfections, as paramitas, are actualized through deep zazen. Deep zazen, that is zazen beyond self and other, beyond thought, is the highest form of giving, the highest form of morality. And effort. It's an effortless effort. And patience, acceptance. Of course, meditation and wisdom. So in the Zen school, we take these six Buddhist principles, perfections, and bring them all into reality, into full realization in pure zazen. Now, people with minds should think clearly. Among the pains and troubles of the four bad dispositions, which would you not fear? So again, here he's beseeching us to take seriously the possibility of our karmic effects of our actions and the possibility of falling into one of these four lowest realms of unenlightened existence: hells, hungry ghosts, animals, and fighting demons. The blessings and powers of humanity and godhood cannot be relied on either. Those are the two highest of the six realms. Anyway, the four realities of disciples are good practice for each of them. Everything in this world is misery. Impermanent, it is a desolate house. Whatever may be eventually returns to emptiness. Even one's body is not one's own possession. How much less wives, children, valuables, or kingship, followers, oxen, horses, and so forth. When you die, you go alone. Who goes with you? What can you take along with you? This is the kind of teaching that prompts some people to brand Buddhism a pessimistic religion. But it's not pessimistic, it's realistic. It faces the fact that we are all just passing through, and we have this wonderful opportunity. This is why it's not pessimistic. We have this great opportunity to free ourselves from our bondage to these forces that perpetuate our suffering. He goes on developing this. Strangers in the present were parents and children, husbands and wives in former lives. Oh, let me reread that. Strangers in the present, so someone you meet when you go to the library or get your oil changed in your car. Strangers in the present were parents and children, husbands and wives in former lives. Parents and children and husband and wives of the present are strangers of the future. Just pause and say that, you know, no one who practices Zen needs to buy any of that. You can just dismiss it. But what if he's right? What if everyone we meet, even strangers, we have known in the past, we have had some karmic connection with? What if those we cherish so dearly now, husbands and wives, children, parents, will in the future become strangers to us? I think you can't believe this teaching without feeling the importance of working on oneself, doing what work we can while we have this method of all methods, this ability to purify the mind, purify our karma, and learn to move along with loss, losing people closest to us. You know, you don't have to go around thinking about this stuff. You don't, when you go to a department store, you go to a mall, and the cashier is ringing up your purchase, You don't have to be carrying around your mind, oh, this could have been my daughter, my wife, because what happens through practice is you come to know in your body that everything, all of our encounters, all of our meetings with people, arise through an affinity of some kind. And there's no need to make a big deal out of it. There is a kind of appreciation of everyone we meet, even complete strangers, appreciating them not just because they're Buddhas, they're enlightened just as they are and have this bodhisattva nature as well, but because we are meeting them, because there is, our very meeting them means there's an affinity. And this, perhaps there's no point in talking about this, but it does make all of these seemingly chance encounters have greater meaning and causes us to respect those whom we meet. He goes on, oxen, horses, fish, and birds of the present are relatives of former lives. Relatives now are oxen, horses, fish, and birds of the future. Drawn by force of actions, following circumstances, it's hard to judge what form of life, what kind of body one may have to experience. Therefore, once you are separated from your parents and children, husbands or wives, those closest to you in the present, you don't know where they are or what they turned out to be. Even the closeness of bone and flesh is only for 50 years. It is like deeply loving an overnight guest, disliking other people. When the night is over and the friend leaves, that friend goes east or west, wandering on alone. The people you didn't like before become friends for a night. In Tibetan Buddhism, they often teach that everyone we meet or don't meet, everyone in the world has been our mother, as a way of evoking this love toward even strangers, and not to mention enemies, the people who we have trouble with. He goes on, the only thing worthy of prayer and trust is enlightenment. The only thing to be sought is the actualization of Buddhahood. This body is a skin bag of habitual obstructions produced by the 12-fold routine of conditioning. First, you must break up the root of ignorance. Once the root is broken, the branches and leaves cannot remain. The meaning of the word kensho, or a first seeing into the nature of things, is just that, seeing things as they are, seeing the true nature of things. This then is what breaks up the root of ignorance. And then again he runs through the six paramitas. Practice generosity with goods and teaching according to your means. Keep the Buddhist precepts without violating them. Be patient with people and don't become angry. Pray and pledge to the Buddhas and spirits morning and night. This is the translator's rendering of, Tore's way of talking about effort, applying oneself and both one, not just one's zazen, but in whatever one's devotions may be in practice. If you have free time, sit in meditation. When you hear the true teaching, break through illusion. These are the practices of the six transcendences of bodhisattvas. Although their fundamental natures are the same, Buddhas turn inward while sentient beings run outward. From this moment of error, they have divided into sentient beings of nine realms. Okay, then he goes through these different realms again. This is the meaning of different paths. If you return to the source, these are of the same substance as the Buddhas. Is this not to be hoped for? That is, isn't it worthy of striving to be able to see all realms, all human experience as the functioning of our own Buddha mind? Then he goes on to the third of what he said at the beginning of this text, where the five discriminations, and that is the sense of urgency. Third, the sense of urgency means that if you want to realize the same nature of all Buddhas, first you must clearly understand the root of ignorance. This is done by questioning your own fundamental nature. How to do this? Seeing colors with the eyes, hearing sounds with the ears, feeling cool and hot with the body, discerning pleasant and unpleasant in the mind. This is called seeing, hearing, awareness, knowing. These are the seeds of practice. Ordinary people get confused by form when they see it. They get confused by sound when they hear. They get confused by cold and hot when they feel. They get confused by pleasant and unpleasant when they think. This is what I call sentient beings turning outward. Okay, let's restate all this. Let's go back to the mandate in Zen practice of learning to be present, fully present in whatever we're doing, wherever we are. When we are fully present, we will hear sounds with the ears, see colors with the eyes. We will feel differences in temperature. We will know what is going on with the mind, with the body mind. In other words, this is awareness. This is presence of mind. On the other hand, he said, ordinary people get confused by these different things, these sense experiences and by thoughts, which just means confused because of clinging to the sound, clinging to the feeling, clinging to the thought. This is the link of the 12 we mentioned earlier this morning. This is the link that Zen bores in on, is this habit of clinging to things. And when we don't cling, when we can learn to not cling, then we find that all of these six senses, the five ordinary senses, and even our thoughts, that these can become liberating. Our experience is entirely different. But it all comes down to the clinging or not clinging. And that's where we are getting practice, just by noticing when thoughts come into the mind or other things, and just going back to the practice. That's not clinging. That is non-clinging. And that's the gist of it all. When we do that, when we can do that more and more effectively in our sitting, then we find, of course, that it transfers to when we're not sitting. We don't get stuck in our experiences. We don't get attached to things. We move along with change. So the problem is not just the pure hearing, but then thinking about what we're hearing, having associations, memories, thoughts, and so forth. And it's the same with the other five senses and thought. Thought need not be a problem. Having thoughts filing through the mind is no big deal. It's when we get snagged by our thoughts, when we get involved with them, this is when we fall. This is where we go astray. So this is one of the most, very most important principles of meditation, is not to see thoughts as a problem, because they're not. If they just arise and they flit through the mind and they just keep going, that's not a problem. It's our making war on our thoughts. It's our shrinking from, fleeing from our thoughts. It's making a big deal out of them, basically, is that's what gets us in trouble. How do we not make a big deal out of our thoughts? By just returning the mind to the practice again and again and again. We don't need to do anything with the thoughts. Notice them. See, they're there. But the mind, the attention is directed to the breath or whatever one's practice is. And then he uses as an example the practice of what is this? He says, as for the practice of bodhisattvas, when they see forms, they question what it is that sees. When they hear, they question what hears. When they feel, they question what feels. When they think, they question what thinks. This is what I call the Buddha's turning inward. So this is using all of our perceptions and experiences, using them in the service of developing a questioning mind. And through this questioning, finding our way through the phenomena themselves to see what is beyond them. It's the same with who am I? Who is hearing? Who is feeling? Who is in pain? Who is having thoughts? Who's tired? Who's drowsy? Who's irritated? Who's having doubts? Or what is it that does all these things? Very, very similar practices. When you practice like this, he goes on, your orientation is different from that of ordinary people. As mentioned before, it is the same as the orientation of the Buddhas, and even if you don't fully realize their wisdom and powers, you should realize that a fledgling bodhisattva has entered the intermediate state. In other words, it's a different orientation than other people have. It's different because when you're questioning like that, you're not getting caught up in the phenomena themselves, the perceptions, the experiences, the thoughts. You're maintaining detachment from those things and using them, even though you're detached, you're using them to draw the mind deeper through this questioning. He goes on, always make great vows to the Buddhas, pray to the spirit luminaries, and make pledges to the ancestral teachers. I think what this is all about is Tori is encouraging us to make a practice of these things that we do here. We do every day at the center and in Sesshin, in the Honzan Echo, 10 directions, 3 worlds, all Buddhas, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas. It's that, the ancestral line that we chant, as a way of getting beyond our own self-absorption and opening ourselves. That's what all of these devotional aspects of practice are, opening ourselves to something greater than the self. It's not the same as turning to God, because there's the fundamental understanding in Buddhism that of emptiness, that any God is a no God, and a Buddha and a Bodhisattva is a no Buddha, a no Bodhisattva. These are not entities that have substance to them. It's really in these practices that we do during chanting, it's really just opening our hearts to that which is beyond self and other. And then he says, in this way, fulfill the great matter once and sport in the ocean of vows to help self and others. This is what it all comes down to, and I think what many of us don't realize until our practice has matured quite a bit is we're doing all of this for the sake of all sentient beings, in order to be vehicles of service, of giving, of helping, of compassion. We're purifying our minds because as long as our minds are stained, or to the degree to which our minds are stained with egoism, then we are not really helping others in the best way, even though we may do good things. Goes on, when you get up in the morning, no matter how hurried you are, first arouse this one thought. Try this meditation work in seeing and hearing, and after that, go about your business. I would say this one thought, this isn't to be taken literally as a thought, but this one aspiration. In fact, the word bodhicitta is translated sometimes as the thought of enlightenment or the aspiration to enlightenment. In other words, he's saying, orient yourself toward what is beyond yourself. This is one way to understand what he's saying. Or another way to understand it is, and for people working on a koan, is bring that up. First thing, you get up, bring forth the mu, or the questioning. When you eat, make this thought first and try this meditation. When you go to the toilet, make this thought first and try this meditation. When the day is over and you're going to bed, first sit a while in bed with this thought foremost. Try this meditation before lying down to sleep. This is the practice of the true and straight road of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. disturbed by the fact that you have lost the original nature, which is of the same substance as all the Buddhas, and come to wander through the six realms and four kinds of birth, turn your fundamental nature and urge on your meditational efforts. This is called the sense of urgency. He's really urging us not to do this practice in a half-hearted way, just going through the motions, but to try to keep it alive. Do this practice, both sitting and moving meditation, to do it consciously, to stay awake and alert, and never allow ourselves to be to give way to the force of habit, the thoughts that are incessantly working on the mind. He's saying, don't let time slip away. This is your chance, he's saying. You have this practice, that can reveal the ultimate, can reveal what is beyond everything else, the most precious thing in the world. Don't let it slip away, this opportunity. Don't let it slip away by just plodding through one's habitual routines in a half-dreaming state. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.